This is Audible.
Blink Publishing presents My Thoughts Exactly, written and read by Lily Allen. Introduction. First, a few facts. They're important because this isn't a normal memoir where you find everything out in the order that it happened. I'm too young to write my life story, and I've got no interest in remembering event after event after event. This is how much of this book would read if I did that. Got up. Hair. Makeup, clothes, studio, shoot, performance. Emails, went out, performed, worked, partied, got on aeroplane, tour bus, in car, did it all again, then again, and again. Cycle interrupted by birthing and looking after children before doing it all again. To a degree. It's the degree that I'm interested in. The things in my life that changed events, upended things, upset the cart. Sometimes these were external events I had no control over. My son George was born 3 months prematurely, but had already died inside me. I was stalked for 7 years and felt my life threatened by someone with a severe mental illness, then witnessed his trial. I've been through episodes of mental ill health myself, so I felt for him despite what he did to me, as it's no fucking picnic. I've been sexually harassed as an adult by someone in a position of power whom I trusted, and I was taken advantage of sexually as a young teenager by men that should have known better. Turns out it's an all too common experience. Me too. Sometimes it was me, myself, who wreaked havoc on my own life, as you'll see. Self-destructive. By contrast, some of the things that have changed my life have been more joyous than I could have ever imagined. I have 2 daughters, Ethel and Marnie. I've had success in a career known for its ruthlessness, and which thrives by rejecting most of its applicants, eschews internships, and dispenses with training. But I've found a path through it. I've been showered with kindness and generosity. I've been spoilt. I've been invited everywhere, made to feel welcome, and I've often been applauded, sometimes by tens of thousands of people. I've played the pyramid stage at the Glastonbury Festival, not once, but 3 times. Get me. But the same industry that rewarded me has also been punitive. This is not a complaint, not here anyway, but a fact. I'll explain more as we go along. I've been bullied and pilloried and humiliated in public by the press. The tabloids, as we all know well, especially after the Leveson inquiry, operate on a venal, pernicious, dishonest and abusive basis. Young people, women especially, are easy fodder for them to bully. Especially when we are new to fame and success and a bit puffed up with the novelty of it all, while still being naive and easily bruised, quick to take offence and easy to bait. I've taken the bait sometimes. I've learnt some difficult lessons and made a load of mistakes, but I've also been spied on and followed and had my words twisted into lies, and that has been paralysing and isolating. I've made friends through work and lost them, but I've also got friends I've had since I was a small child. That's a blessing. In fact, mostly I've been surrounded by love, even when I felt profoundly unlovable. We all live with shadows. Mine have been magnified somewhat because I'm in the public eye, but I don't claim them to be darker than anyone else's. It's just that I can only talk about my own, and at times they've felt pitch black. Sometimes I made them darker than they needed to be, but it can be hard to let the light in when you're troubled, and I've been troubled. This is the story of all those times and my thoughts about them. It's not a straight memoir. It's not even a straight story. Is any? It is my story. It's entirely true to me, but I don't claim it to be the only truth. For example, my brother will have his own version of events, even though we were born 16 months apart and grew up next to each other. So will my ex-husband, even though we were together for 6 years, much of that time happily, and had 3 children together, and had to bury one. We bring up our daughters together, still. So, this is me. I am Lily Allen. I was born in 1985. I'm a songwriter and a singer, a mother, a daughter, sister, homemaker. I was once a wife. I'm someone's girlfriend. That someone is called Dan. He's a musician too. I'm an activist, socially and politically. I'm a tweeter. I'm a Labour voter. I'm a writer. I've been a success and a failure. I'm unqualified and mostly self-taught. I didn't go to university, I didn't do A-levels, I didn't sit a single GCSE. I didn't grow up in a particularly musical household, but performance was always around me. The media world was never a special or glamorous beacon, but my norm. My mum, Alison Owen, is a film producer. My dad, Keith Allen, is an actor, comedian and documentary maker. My stepdad, for a time, was the comedian Harry Enfield. I've got an older half-sister called Sarah, a younger brother, Alfie, and a much younger half-sister called Teddy. I have other half-siblings too, but I don't know them or even know how many there might be. Not a straight story. My first boyfriend was Lester, my best friend is Seb, and we now work together too. He's a music producer. The man I married is called Sam Cooper, and he has a building company. We separated in the autumn of 2015. I grew up going to Glastonbury and the Groucho Club. My dad was part of the Britpop scene, getting publicly loaded with his friends, Damien Hirst, Alex James, and others. Drugs and alcohol have been a part of my white noise, always around me, for as long as I can remember. I have used both, sometimes to excess, and although I've been to NA and AA meetings and have had sober periods of my life, I am not a recovering alcoholic or drug addict. I do, however, suffer with depression. Not a straight story. I did go to various private schools as well as state ones, but I didn't stay at any of them for very long, so I'm not a product of any one particular system or institution. I started singing as a child at school, but discovered music as a young teenager and kept it close to me from then on. I read. I keep notebooks. I've got a good eye. I collect textiles. I love colour, and decorating or doing up a house doesn't faze me at all. I exercise, but I'm not a natural athlete. I'm a swimmer. I'm strong. I can be tough. I've been broken. I'm opinionated. I'm a people pleaser. I'm a narcissist. I'm a codependent. I don't always like being alone, though equally there are times when I can't bear company. I'm spoilt. I'm needy. I can be a hypocrite. I contradict myself. I can be cold. But I can also see sense. I can connect the dots. I try to do good. I want to do good. I'm impassioned. I'm observant. And I notice things. I have a photographic memory. I remember names, places, things, although there are whole periods of my life that are hazy and washed out. The lights are out. I cook, not all the time, but often. I'm a trained florist. I drive well, and I have an excellent sense of direction. I'm financially independent, and I make my own money, sometimes quite a lot of it, but I also run up debt. I made my own way in my career. You have to. Even if you get a leg up, there's no other way to do it. I find a lot of things funny, and I laugh a lot. Sometimes even when things aren't that funny. Sometimes it's like a tick. Laugh, Lily, laugh, and it'll make things easier. Lighter, more absurd, right? Not always, often not. Like most women I know, I juggle a lot. Work, children, family, money, running a household, steering my own ship. But I haven't always managed. I've fucked up a good deal. I can be a fuck-up. You'll see. I tell the truth. I'm writing this because writing is what I do. It's both my living and the way that I live. The way I make sense of things. The way I try to learn my lessons. I'm writing this so that if I died today, my daughters can learn from my mistakes. And so whatever information they may stumble on about me, I imagine them as adolescents Googling my name. There will be a version in black and white that will not alter in the retelling. Fuck, I'm writing this so that I can learn from my mistakes. I'm writing this to tell my story because telling stories is important, especially if you're a woman. When women tell their stories, loudly and clearly and honestly, things begin to change for the better. This is my story. The Outsider. Growing up, I felt like the outsider in my family. My early years feel hazy and out of focus, as if I didn't have edges or definition. It's unattractive to complain too much about your childhood, and playing the victim, even if you genuinely feel like one, isn't appropriate or constructive in a story like mine. It also isn't necessarily the truth. It's a truth. That doesn't make the story any less valid, but it's worth noting. There are many truths and versions of any story, but the ones from childhood are especially shape-shifting because that's when you should be experiencing everything in the moment most particularly. My truth is that I didn't feel nurtured as a child. I felt lost and invisible and often ignored. That lack of care, or what I take to be a lack, has informed much of my behaviour as an adolescent and an adult. My mum became pregnant with my sister Sarah when she was 18. She wasn't married. She gave birth alone because the night that she went into labour, Sarah's dad was at a Clash concert in Brighton, and her own mum, a staunch Catholic, didn't accompany her to the hospital because she disapproved of the pregnancy. My mum had no one to hold her hand that night. I didn't know that until later on in my life, but it explains a lot to me about my mum and my sister and their extraordinarily tight bond. It must have started that night when they went through that experience, just the two of them. They survived together. I felt outside their circle. I felt I had to survive on my own, and as if I was low down on my parents' list of priorities, below their careers, and less important than Sarah or my baby brother, who arrived 16 months after I was born. However much Alfie and I were together, and we were always bundled up together and treated like peas in a pod, I was also quite an independent little thing, more of a loner than my siblings. I didn't find a slot outside our family unit either. Alfie was passionate about football, for instance, but by contrast, I wasn't into anything in particular, not gymnastics, or ponies, or dolls, or climbing trees, or makeup, or being a tomboy. I know I was loved as a child, but I didn't feel that love very much. My parents were away a lot, absent because of work, mum, or play, dad. They were young when we burst into their lives, and they were busy forming themselves while we were growing up. They both came from provincial working-class families, and they both made it to London and into media careers. They reinvented themselves away from their families and their roots, and that's hard to do. It takes work and energy and focus. It meant there wasn't too much time left over for us kids, so their attitude towards us was along the lines of, the kids will be okay. Let's let them get on with it. As kids, we were left alone a lot. Encouraging us to find hobbies or after-school activities was too much of a commitment and reliant on a routine that they had no interest in. I went to my first weekend activity after Mum got together with Harry, and they signed me up for junior cordon bleu cookery classes on Saturday mornings. I loved it. Instead, I read a lot and loved listening to audiobooks. I watched a lot of TV. The Australian soaps, Neighbours and Home and Away on at tea time each day were part of my daily routine. In the morning before school, I watched breakfast TV. I felt like Gabby Roslin was my TV mum. She looked a bit like my real mum and seemed in control of whatever situation she found herself in. I liked that about her. Even back then, I knew she wasn't prepared to suffer humiliation, at least not because she was a woman who was usually in a sea of lads. Most of all, I liked that she was always there. I switched on the TV, and there she was, always available, never busy or distracted. We weren't a family that did things together. My parents didn't seem to be a couple that did things together either. Certainly, I didn't witness them having any kind of loving relationship. I believe my mum fell totally in love with my dad when they met and got together, and I know she felt bereft and let down by him when he walked out on us. But even when they were together, I don't remember good times. Maybe I was too young. Maybe they didn't happen all that often. I didn't give all this much thought until recently. When I was young, all my friends' parents were divorced. It was just the way things were. No big deal. But it is a big deal, I now realise. First time my boyfriend Dan's son came to stay with us not long ago. He was 3 years old. We spent that weekend together, me and Dan and his boy and my girls, hanging out as a family. After the weekend, Dan told me about a conversation he'd had with his ex. He told me how he had reassured her. Lily and I weren't kissing and cuddling or holding hands in front of the kids. And she'd replied, I don't have a problem with you showing affection to Lily in front of the kids. In fact, it's important for them to see how adults behave with each other when they are in love. When Dan relayed this conversation to me, I thought, how astute this person is. I couldn't stop thinking about what she had said, and then it hit me. Oh my God, I thought, I never saw that when I was young. As a child, I didn't witness any adults in a loving relationship or showing each other affection. Thinking about this affected me deeply. It felt like I'd found a piece of the puzzle as to why I felt like a vessel. Okay on the surface, empty inside, for so long. Because if you say to me, Lily, how did you feel growing up? Did you feel happy or content or loved? Did you bumble along in the moment without too many cares? Which is how I imagine children should, if possible, grow up. Then my answer is this. As a child, and often as an adult, I felt like a beating heart and a pile of skin, but nothing more. Nothing substantial or filled up or whole. Mothers. My mum is Alison. She was brought up in a religious family in Portsmouth, but quickly chose to worship at the altars of socialism and punk rather than Catholicism. She is smart and bright, funny and beautiful. Sometimes people think they've got the measure of her, but they haven't. She's blonde and sexy with big boobs and she's all about her brain. She's a big brain inside a funny little lady. She knew from the get-go that she wanted a career and that she wanted it in film. And yet, even though she was hugely ambitious, she'd had 3 kids by the time she was 24. I get it. I get why she had children so young. She wanted a family, and her own wouldn't do. She went out looking for what she should have had in plenty, but didn't, and that was unconditional love. How great, then, that in 1984 she married the comedian and performer Keith Allen, a man famous for his narcissism and womanizing. Mum and Dad met through a radio show my dad did back in the 1980s called Breakfast Pirate Radio. My mum was a fan of the programme, and she called up looking for work. Dad told her she could have a job if she could get him, Ken Livingstone, on tape. Livingstone was on the Greater London Council back then, and my dad wanted a 15-second clip of him talking. Mum, being the go-getter that she is, went out and got it. Dad was impressed. I think he was even more impressed when he saw her, this clever, dinky person with a Worsley Portsmouth accent and huge tits. He was like, yes, please. Mum was young when she arrived in London. She had Sarah, a toddler, in tow, and she was studying at UCL, so she was living in University Digs in Bloomsbury. The artist, Kareth Wynne Evans, lived on the same block as her with his boyfriend Angus Cook, and so did Lucian Freud's daughter Rose Boyd and the artist Celia Paul. They all became friends. It was quite the scene, and Rose and Mum became close. She's one of my godmothers. Rose was in charge of the guest list for the coolest nightclubs back then, clubs like Zanzibar and The Wag. She was tall, with broad shoulders, and there was no getting past her if she turned her back on you. This is why she was known as The Back. She was The Back, and Mum was The Shelf. It was through Rose that Mum met Nana Cherry and Andrea Oliver and her brother Sean. And they became a gang of friends. Alfie and I grew up with their kids, Naima, Nana's daughter, Andy's kid Makita, and Sean's kids Theo and Phoebe. Phoebe's mum is Tessa Pollitt from The Slits. I was fascinated by them. They always had music in their house. Nana, Andy and Sean were in a post-punk band called Rip, Rig and Panic, and it always seemed like there was something going on in their house. A meal was being cooked or someone was getting their hair braided. Relations were constantly visiting, and if they weren't relatives, they still seemed like family and were called auntie. I spent a lot of time at Makita's house. I loved it there because it felt like a community. Ours felt boring and lonely compared to theirs. At home, I ate pasta with butter and cheese and watched TV, often by myself. We're all still close. Makita and Phoebe were bridesmaids at my wedding, and Theo runs our record label, Bank Holiday Records. Mum and Dad's marriage lasted long enough to produce me and Alfie, but I don't think that they were together much. They were both busy with their careers and their social lives. They spent time forming proper friendships with the people that they were meeting rather than with each other. That's one reason I'm so close to my godparents and many of my parents' friends, because if we were spending time with my parents, then chances are it was when they were with their usually separate friends too. I've got just one memory of my mum and dad together as a couple. I was in Mum's bedroom and I saw a man, my dad, in her bed. That's it. Dad left when I was 4. I didn't have much of a connection with him, so in one sense it wasn't a big event. The notion cooked up years later of me being Daddy's little girl was invented by the media. Sometimes I come across photos of Alfie and me as kids hanging out with our dad, but they were all set-ups. Keith Allen and his kids looking sweet together in go-karting jumpsuits. We didn't go-karting with Dad. It was a promo pic for a documentary that he was involved in. Keith Allen playing with his tots and holding one of them upside down. That was another workshop when Dad was in the comic strip. A group of comedians in the 1980s who became well known for their alternative take on comedy. I wasn't close to my dad when we were growing up, not because I was angry with him or punishing him. I didn't get to see enough of him to play out those feelings. I wasn't close to Keith because he wasn't around. Soon after Dad left, Mum got together with Harry Enfield. They met at a dinner party given by my godfather, Danny Kleinman, a director my mum had met when she first came to London and who is still one of her oldest, closest, proper friends. They were so close that Danny often felt like the dad that I should have had. Harry felt like that too. I think it's interesting that Mum knew that for all Dad's anarchic socialism, what he really wanted to be was a rich and successful comedian. And here she was, moving on from Dad and moving in with the most successful comedian of the day. I accepted Harry straight away. I was like, well, if Mum is okay, then I'm okay. I did that as a child. I fell in with things. That's what you learn to do as a child if the two people you love the most appear to have disappeared on you. You become a people pleaser because you're always guarding against further rejection. Rejection was the haze in which I lived as a child. My automatic response to any situation was, okay, I'll do whatever you want. Honestly, anything you want, as long as you stick around. It's a response that I fell into with men, too, as I grew older and began having my own relationships. Harry wasn't just successful and well off. He was kind and he was reliable. he and Mum were together for about 5 years, and while we lived with Harry in a big lovely house in Primrose Hill, he gave us stability and structure. When we were kids, Mum was away, producing films a lot, on set or abroad. Films are demanding. They require a producer's full attention and pretty much all their time, and Mum gave her work her all. It was Harry who spent time with us and thought about what would be best. Not just for him, but for us as children. Every Saturday, he and I had a routine. He'd pick me up from the cooking classes he'd signed me up for, and we'd go shopping at Gap Kids and then have lunch together at our favourite Chinese restaurant. Mum went away a lot because of her work, but that wasn't the only reason she was absent. When I was about 7 or 8, she started taking drugs with one of her close friends. I guess it was kind of a phase of drug-taking in an ab-fab hilarious let's-get-out-of-it-darling sort of way. I guess. Mum's friend lived on Talbot Road, near the Portobello Road. Portobello was a place where both Mum and I would end up spending lots of time, together and apart. I would later live on that corner with my godfather Danny, and later with my boyfriend for a time, Seb, and again with another boyfriend, Ed. Different flats, same corner. You can see through the windows of all four properties from all four, so I feel like it's a locus for me, that corner. A central point in my universe, one of the ley lines of my life. It can't be coincidental either. It's one of those places that feels energetic to anyone who goes there, and it's a magnet for all kinds of people, rich and poor, black and white, old and young. It's around the corner from Portobello Market and all the energy that a vibrant market brings to a neighbourhood. It's there that you still go to find cheap vintage clothes and good records and delicious street food, and where there are all kinds of coffee shops and cafes and after-hours nightclubs, so the whole place attracts people who are in some way determined to express their individuality and nail down their style. I loved West London when I was growing up. Sarah's patch was Islington, North London, and Alfie went to a Steiner school in North London, so he had his friends from there. But my friends, Jess, Phoebe and Makita and their families had all moved west, and Portobello was our stomping ground. I think Mum liked using her friend's flat as a place to escape to. She kept the fact that she was using quite separate from Harry. It's a way of convincing yourself that you are containing your habit, isn't it? To cordon it off into a different place or section of your life. It's also one reason why Mum travelled so much. No, no, I'm fine, really. Putting all this shit into my body isn't something I do in my real life. It's just a bit of fun that I have in my parallel life, on Talbot Road, or when I'm away, working, my wind down, a way of coping with pressure, you know? I do know. I know how it all works because I did it when I was married to Sam. You try and hold it together when you're around your partner, but that's hard and it makes you feel like you're suffocating. So you plan yet another work trip away. And the trips are legitimate and they are for work. You're not living a lie, but you do more than are necessary. You aren't being honest either. You pay more attention to your work life in order to service your drug habit at the expense of neglecting your family, which makes you feel guilty, so you plan more work trips to run away from your feelings of guilt. It's an exhausting, destructive cycle. When we were young, Mum would return from her trips to America with stuff for us to open. Packages of American sweets, stickers, Disney stuff, clothes from shops that weren't yet in London. It was guilt booty. I'd be excited about the presents, of course, but really what I was excited about was, Mum's back, Mum's here. But all too quickly, she'd be off on another trip. That's what Mum did. I knew she went away to work, and I accepted it, but I didn't know what else was going on back then. I understand it now too well. You leave your kids, and that's painful. You feel guilty. You feel disengaged when you return. You don't know your kids as well as you should. Mothering them feels foreign and hard. It feels easier to keep escaping. One way to escape is to drink or take drugs. Another way is to keep going away. Mum did both. And so later did I. I love Mum, and I'll always preface any bad stories about her with how amazing and how tenacious she is, and how she's accomplished so much because she is, and has. We've been through some shit together, but here we are, decades later, and we're still really close. So some things went right. But not everything. When I was 8 years old, I went to a school in Camden called Cavendish. Mum had just started working as a film producer at Working Title, and though she got help with us kids, we didn't always have a proper nanny or someone taking charge. At pick-up time one day, because she was too busy taking drugs at her friend's house, she phoned up her office and sent a runner who was working there to collect me from school and bring me to her friend's. The runner had never met me before, but he did as he was asked. He ordered an Addison Lee car, got to the school on time, picked up Lily, took her to the Talbot Road address my mum had given him, and watched as she was buzzed into the flat. Then he returned to the office. Lily went into the flat where she found 7-year-old Alfie and his best friend Theo watching TV. She sat down and watched it with them. Mum and her pal were there, but they didn't see or notice the kids. They were downstairs, hanging out together. Meanwhile, moments after Lily had been picked up by the runner, Lily's mum arrived at the school to collect her daughter, only she wasn't there. The runner had got the wrong Lily. The wrong Lily was at the Talbot Road house, but no one at the school knew this. All anyone knew was that this Lily had disappeared with a young man, no one had seen him before, into an Addison Lee car. Meanwhile, I was left waiting at the school, and although it wasn't so hard to unravel the mistake, nobody was answering the phone at my house. It was mostly landlines back in those dark days, because no one was there. They were all at Talbot Road, too busy watching TV or knocking back booze and drugs to notice what had gone wrong. It took a while, hours, not minutes, to put things back to rights and restore the lilies to their correct homes. The incident didn't make me feel good. It added to me feeling like I didn't exist. Not long after that, things reached a crisis point with Mum. I came home from school one day and she was in her bedroom with empty vodka and pill bottles all around her. She was crawling along the floor saying, "The house is shouting at me to get out." She was very distressed. I rang Harry. I felt like I was betraying Mum by ringing him when I saw her in that state, but I didn't know what else to do. "Something's wrong with Mum," I said to him on the phone. "I'm scared." I finished at Cavendish after year six, when I was 11, and somehow got a sports scholarship. I was quite good at hockey, it turned out, to a posh, sporty prep school in Somerset called Edgar Lee Hall. I'd probably been up for the idea of boarding school because when I was about 11, I began to read kids' books about the Second World War. I started with Carrie's War, and then there was the book with the memorable title, When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit. And of course I devoured The Diary of Anne Frank. But the ones that I was attracted to most were the ones about child evacuees. It was the first time as a child that I felt like I identified with anything. Those stories chimed with me because I had this dream of being shipped off somewhere. These kids, even though it was horrible that they were yanked away from their homes and put on trains and sent to the countryside, what they got at the end of the train ride were mother figures that looked after them, cooked for them, and encouraged them to play in the garden with the other kids. Edgar Lee Hall, however, was not the idyll that I had imagined. I hated it there. It was too far away from London to go home very often, and much too traditional. I didn't understand the references to Sloane Ranger life, and I wasn't familiar with the rituals that came naturally to most of the kids there. The jokes and manners and codes and certain way of talking and eating and behaving that you acquire if you grow up in a big house in the country with staff and ponies and dogs and parents who are rooted in the establishment. I felt isolated from the other kids and isolated from my family, and that feeling wasn't helped when I was left waiting to be picked up one Saturday afternoon. When you're at boarding school like Edgar Lee, you get to go home for one weekend, twice a term. Those weekends, or exeats, one each side of half term, are precious. There was a coach that ferried the kids from Somerset to London so that the parents who lived in the capital or abroad didn't have to drive for hours to collect their offspring only to turn around and drive hours home. But when the coach arrived at the Royal Albert Hall, its designated London drop-off point, I was left waiting with the teacher for someone to pick me up. No one did. Mum had asked my sister Sarah to get me. Mum herself was too busy. Sarah didn't show up. I felt humiliated and forgotten and alone. The teacher's face was a picture. Of all the children to be forgotten, it would be you. Her witnessing my humiliation only added to it. I had to get back on the bus and return to Somerset. Of course, later that night, my mum bustled around repairing the situation and trying to make good. She arranged for a family friend who lived near the school to come and pick me up the next day. That wasn't what I wanted, though. What I wanted was for her to get in the car and drive like the Clappers that same night, however late it was, wrap me in her arms and take me home. The whole situation just seemed to confirm my feelings that Sarah and Mum had a special bond from which I was excluded. They were in London. I was away at boarding school, outside their magic circle. I wasn't allowed in. I'd always subconsciously resented Sarah because of her bond with Mum. But after that incident, I had actual conscious reason to resent her. She had forgotten me. Everything was her fault. I also subconsciously blamed Sarah when Harry and Mum broke up in 1996 and we moved out of Harry's house and into a place in Islington. Sarah was badly behaved as a teenager. She was wild. Harry was the third father in her life and she'd already been failed by two. She was done by the time he came on the scene. All bets were off. She pushed every boundary she could. She looked older than her years and she was tall and thin and gorgeous. She was sexy and she was smart. People wanted her around. She could get into any club, go to any party, and so that's what she did. I think Harry was patient for years, but he reached a point where he gave my mum an ultimatum. It must have gone something like this. "You've either got to deal with your daughter or I can't go on living with you anymore, at least not like this." Mum interpreted this as having to make a choice between him and Sarah. Obviously, she chose Sarah. Of course, their breakup was more complicated than that, but that's how I saw it. Sometimes Mum's heavy work schedule worked to our advantage. When I was 14, Mum's film Elizabeth started going into production. It became a big success and was nominated for 7 Oscars. Even though it hadn't been shot with a big budget or regarded as hit material with commercial appeal, it was a period story directed by an unknown Indian director, Shekhar Kapoor, who Mum had believed in, and it was Cate Blanchett's first big role outside of Australia. Mum was in a good place when she was working on Elizabeth. She was clean and finding success. I was between schools, and so she arranged for me to travel around with her and be tutored on set. I was proud of Mum, and I loved being with her in her world, even if she was too busy to actually hang out with us much. She was the boss on that film set. It was she who had put it all together, and it was she who was running the show. No one knew what would happen with the film or how successful it would turn out to be, but you could tell that it was brilliant day by day. Sarah and Alfie and I all had parts in the film as courtiers, but if I wasn't dressed up and on set, then I'd hang out with the makeup artist Jenny Sherkor, who I'd known since I was little because she'd done lots of work with my mum and dad over the years. She looked after me. The hair and makeup people, they're nearly always women, are always the nicest to hang out with on a film set. Mum liked hanging out with them too. On Oscar night in LA, Eric Fellner and Tim Bevan, who run Working Title and who are also producers of the film, didn't seat Mum next to them and Shaker and the stars of the film. They put her and Jenny and Alexandra Byrne, who did the costumes, in seats towards the back of the room, even though all of them were nominated for Oscars. Mum didn't care. She was thrilled to sit with her friends, and, in the end, Jenny was the star of the show because she was the only one who actually won an Oscar for Elizabeth. But I found it odd looking at Tim and Eric, two men who'd rarely visited the set, sitting in what they regarded as the prime seats and taking all the credit. There was one day on that set that was stressful. It was a big production day with a lot going on. I think they were filming a complicated dancing scene at a court with Cate and Joseph Fiennes at the centre of it. I did something annoying on set. I can't remember what, but it distracted Cate and she snapped at me. Cate was nice generally, but there was a lot of pressure on her that day. It wasn't a big deal, except I was 14 years old and to me it was a huge deal. I was horrified and embarrassed. I went back to my mum's trailer and wrote a 2-page apology letter. Otherwise, I loved the experience of being on set with Mum while she was working, and I loved playing lady-in-waiting E. But not once on that set did I think that I'd want to become an actor. The fact is, I'm not a natural performer. Being on stage with an audience doesn't come easily to me, and it's not the applause that gets me excited when I'm there. I'm not in my comfort zone up on that platform, not at all. What I love is seeing people connect with the lyrics I've written. When you see that people have memorized and then are singing words that you've written, that's amazing. Just seeing even one person respond to your words. The fact that I might also be entertaining them is an added bonus. It's that that gets me and makes me want to get on stage. But the stage is not where I feel at home. Of course, I could become a better performer. I could write bigger choruses or stick more catchy earworms into my songs or take more dance classes and learn about movement and writhe around the stage more, but that's not why I get up there. I do it to sing songs that I've written. Writing songs is cathartic, but nothing compares to when someone else is responding to them. That feels like a relief. When I write, what I'm trying to do is make sense of something in my life. Often it's something that I've been unsuccessful at solving. So when people connect, it feels like they're saying, yes, I understand, and no, you're not alone, and it's okay, you aren't going mad, and yes, I felt that way too. I'm happier working it all out behind the scenes. I'm like my mum in that way. She does it by finding material and creating a team. I do it by writing and crafting a song. My dad is different. He's all about performance. He's a narcissist. He likes people looking at him for whatever reason, good or bad. Either will do, all the time. Fathers. I didn't know much about Dad when I was young, except that he was an actor. He wasn't commercially successful. He was and is brilliant at what he does, writing, acting, comedy, stand-up, but he's a self-saboteur. I understand that, as I am too. He was part of the comic strip in the 1980s, and I hear him get name-checked by comedians from that era as one of their heroes. But unlike many of them, he couldn't channel his comedic gifts into a proper career. He did this one-man show in the Docklands back then when he came on stage naked and didn't allude to it for the first 12 minutes or so of the set, and people still talk to me about it. No one had done anything like that before. He was new and original and anarchic, but he couldn't sustain anything. Sustaining something takes work, after all. You can be brilliant once, but to keep doing it over and over is hard and intimidating, and that's what I think he was scared of, keeping it up. Dad could be charming, he's clever, He was good looking. When I think about him back when we were little, I mostly remember him driving us to places. He drove a Citroen and then dumping us there. Anywhere, really. The Juice and Nacho stall in Camden run by a friend of his, say, or usually the Groucho Club. Occasionally, Alfie and I spent weekends in one of the hotel rooms at Groucho's, eating Toblerones from the minibar while Dad got smashed in the bar downstairs with his mates. Groucho's was part of my life from a young age. I knew the phone number off by heart by the time I was 6. How depressing is that? The name rings true for me too, because it really is a club I do not want to be a part of, and yet they will have me as a member. God knows I've spent enough time there over the years. Enough even to be barred entry for a month at a time once or twice over the years after being caught doing drugs in the loo. But when we were young, a room there was Dad's idea of childcare. Dad didn't do much of that. Childcare, that is. Mostly when it came to Dad looking after us, it was cancellations, crap excuses and disappointments. He did once offer to help out my mum when she was making her first film, Hear My Song. They were still together then. The film was made in Ireland and Mum took us kids there while she was working on it, enrolling us in the local school and nursery in Leakslip. I was 4, Alfie was 3 and Sarah was 10. "Alison, I imagine," he said, "you're stressed out. I'm going to take the kids on holiday for a week to the south of France so you can get on with your work." "Thanks, Keith," she must have replied, presumably surprised that he was kicking in. "That would be a great help. Thank you." Dad had booked a hotel between Saint-Tropez and Nice, and when we went up to our room, we discovered that his friend, Naira, who worked at the comic strip as the company's secretary, was staying in the room next door. They did the whole, "Oh my God, how weird to see you here. You're on holiday. You on your own? Come and hang out with us," thing, but there was no kidding Sarah. Alfie and I bought into it, but Sarah knew. Dad and Naira were already having an affair. They'd planned the holiday so that they could be away together. Soon after that, Dad and Mum split up, and we hardly saw Dad at all. Maybe Mum, angry, said, "You're not seeing the kids," or maybe he just didn't want to see us. Mostly I remember him moving out of our flat in Bloomsbury and away from us, his family, and into a little flat on the Waldo Road in northwest London with a pig called Morris. It wasn't a dinky micro pig or one of those black pot-bellied ones either, but a real fat Gloucester Old Spot type, pink fucking pig. I trust that for a time at least they were happy together. Dad didn't like it when Mum got together with Harry. He was horrible about him. He called Harry a dick. "I know, Dad. You left Mum in a ditch with 3 kids to look after, and Harry, who everyone adores and who doesn't take cocaine, took on the family that you abandoned without complaint. What a dick." Dad and Ira got married when I was 11. The wedding was in a church on Haverstock Hill in Hampstead. Alfie sang Where Is Love from the film Oliver. I sang the song made famous by Bette Midler, The Rose. "Some say love, it is a river," the lyrics go, "that drowns the tender reeds." I just started singing lessons at school. I enjoyed them immediately, though I had no idea yet that using my voice would become my calling. My granddad was sitting in the front row. He'd been a submariner in the Royal Navy all his life, spending months away at a time under the sea, apart from his family. My dad's mum was Welsh and from a big, warm family, but his dad was from a strict English family who valued discipline above joy. He was short-backed, stocky, tough, not a free-spirited man. Near him sat Damien Hirst, and just across the aisle was Eddie Izzard wearing thigh-high PVC boots. It was that kind of wedding. The marriage didn't last. My dad wasn't faithful to Naira either. For example, when I was travelling to Thailand back in 2002, I met a girl on the beach and we got chatting. She said, "You know what, I think you might know my sister, Tara. She used to hang out with your dad back in the day." I remembered Tara instantly, the moment she said her name. Tara was the young woman who did the tees at the cricket games my dad took us to when he and Mum were still together. She had peroxide blonde hair and wore bright red lipstick and had a beauty spot on her face, just like Madonna's. She was unbelievably sexy. Without thinking about it, I said to the girl, "They were having an affair, right?" "Yeah," Tara's sister replied straightforwardly. "That's right." I thought, well, there we are. Even at 3 years old, I had known on some level that something wasn't right. But then you could probably mention any woman my dad has hung out with, and chances are, if she's been up for it, they've shagged. Seems quite a lot of women were up for it. Shaggers do get laid, though, don't they? If you try it on often enough, you get some. I think Dad has about 11 children in all, or maybe it's 13, or perhaps I'm exaggerating and it's 8 or 9. I don't know. There's me and Alfie and my half-sister Teddy, whose mum, Tamsin, Dad has been with for 15 years now. But there's a load more. Some of whom are semi-official and others who we don't know much about, but who Dad has fathered just the same. I do see my dad still, but I've learnt over the years that everything is about him, so fine, that's the deal. I've stopped trying to fight or bustle about trying to find a spare slot in his universe. There isn't one. I'm sure when he thinks about how he fathered me, he thinks, well, I did a better job than my own dad. I wasn't cold or joyless. I wasn't a strict bastard. I was fun. I took my kids to the football and the cricket, even if I was getting my leg over with the blonde who did the tees. I was a laugh. I embraced good times. Dad would be right in many ways, if that's what he thinks. He compensated for what he'd lacked as a child and behaved differently from his own father. But it doesn't matter how funny someone is if they aren't around, or if when they are around they only want the laughs to be directed towards them. Going to the football with your dad can be fun, of course, but when every time you're the tag-along while he hangs out with his mates, the treat loses some of its value. I spent the years trying to shout, Dad, I'm here, what do I have to do to get you to look at me? I never could. Whatever I did, however successful or however messy I became, either way, I couldn't get my dad to pay me attention, not as a child and not as an adult. The penny dropped hard when I played Latitude in 2014. I was headlining that festival, which is a big deal, at least for most people. Festivals don't ask women singers to headline very often, more's the pity, and in fact I was only asked to do it at the last minute after the original headline act Two Door Cinema Club cancelled because their lead singer was ill. I was especially nervous because there had been press about how outraged some of the Two Door Cinema Club fans were getting landed with Lily Allen instead of their favourite band. Dad was at Latitude. He'd been in charge of organising their comedy tent for years, so he was a regular there. After Glastonbury, it had become his thing. He came to see me in my dressing room before I went on, but then he said that he had to go. Good luck, he said. I'm off now. I was gobsmacked that he was leaving. I got my own responsibilities here, Lily, he explained. A job to do in my own tent. Dad, I said, I don't think anyone at the comedy tent would begrudge you if you said, you know what, guys, I know this is my tent, but can you hold the fort for an hour or two while I watch my daughter headline this festival that we're all at? I was like, I'm sorry, Dad, but I'm just not buying it. I remember thinking, how the fuck am I meant to interpret him leaving apart from something really fucked up going on? I was congratulated by people who were there watching me, my friends, my godmother Henrietta, my friend Matthew, who sent me a text message as soon as I'd finished saying how proud he was of me and how he'd been in tears watching me, and I remember thinking, I want this from my dad, who was right here, a field away from me, but didn't come to see me perform one of the most challenging and important concerts of my career. That's what it's been like with Dad all my life. He has been there, around, in the same town as us, sometimes in the same building, but never with us. He was always downstairs in the bar with his mates, or pursuing women, or chasing drugs. What he wanted was attention, all the time. He wasn't interested in paying attention to us. Instead, we lived in the sidelines of his life, and there we have remained. Presumably, it's not coincidental, then, that one of the things I yearned for as I reached adulthood was to be the centre of attention. Ditto, you could surmise. My being attracted to older men, subsequent codependency, not being able to say no, and my habit of people-pleasing, as well as my disregard for authority. This last trait, partly due, I think, to my dad being unreliable as any kind of voice of authority, as well as it being stamped into my DNA, given that I am the daughter of an anarchist socialist comedian who didn't give a shit about anyone except for himself, lol, proved to be particularly unhelpful when it came to my education. Hear My Song, my mum's first film, by the way, was a success. Diana, Princess of Wales, came to the premiere. I was a flower girl and gave her a posy. Alfie had a box of handkerchiefs to give her, but somehow he got his knob caught in his trouser zip moments before meeting her. He was crying when she approached him. Are you okay? She asked him. No, he replied. I've got my willy caught in my zip. An education. I went to 9 different schools in all. The first was a state primary called St. Joseph's in Bloomsbury, while we were living at my mum's in UCL Diggs. When we moved to a flat in Shepherd's Bush, mum's friend Siobhan persuaded her to send us kids to private schools. Sarah and I went to Queen's Gate because that's where Siobhan's daughter Jess went. When my mum got together with Harry, they moved us to this ultra-traditional school in Chelsea called Hill House, where the kids wear a uniform of breeches and mustard-coloured socks so that they look like they're going game shooting in Scotland. That didn't last long, and so I was moved to a more local primary school in Camden called Cavendish. I liked Cavendish. It was there that I was first encouraged to sing. There was a teacher there called Rachel Santesso, and it was she who first gave me singing lessons. Miss Santesso was great. I liked her a lot. I did my first solo at Cavendish too, and that was significant for me because it was something that I was chosen to do. For a child who feels invisible growing up, that's a big deal. The song was Baby Mine from Dumbo. The headmistress at Cavendish was also a sympathetic person. She let me know, without making a big deal about it, that she was looking out for me. But Cavendish was a primary school, and it came to an end when I completed year 6 and I was 11 years old. It was after that that I went to board at Edgerly Hall. I may not have liked Edgerly or stayed there long, but my time there was important in that the school took my singing ability seriously. At Edgerly, I had proper voice lessons that began with scales and learning how to sing arias and ended, once the hard work was done, with singing something more accessible like a show tune or songs from a musical. Because Edgerly was a sporty school, not many of the kids were into drama or singing, and so my singing stood out. There was another good singer there, though. She was called Olivia, and she was in the year above me. She was blonde and tall and extremely pretty, and all the boys loved her. When we sang together in an assembly, she sang the song The Rose, and I sang Somewhere from West Side Story. That's why I chose to sing The Rose at Dad and Naira's wedding. I didn't choose it for the lyrics, however apt they may have been, but because I wanted to knock Olivia off the top spot and claim her song as my own. Still, however envious I was of Olivia, it was me that was chosen to sing the solo in the school's Christmas carol concert at Wells Cathedral. The song was In the Bleak Midwinter, and never was a title more fitting, because on the way from London to Wells, Mum and Alfie had a car crash, and so it was a bleak night indeed. The carol also took on extra significance years later when I moved to Gloucestershire with Sam, because I discovered that Gustav Holst had been inspired to write the music by his childhood visits to Cranham, our nearest village. I'd assumed Mum and Alfie had been watching me from one of the pews in the cathedral, but when I got back to school with the rest of the pupils, I was the only child whose family had failed to make it. I then assumed I'd been forgotten again, but just as I was starting my poor me routine, Mr. Maguire, the housemaster, took me aside. He explained that Mum had had to swerve to avoid a lorry driving dangerously in the middle of the road. Her little car had ended up on its roof in a ditch, and Mum and Alfie had to be cut out of the car and taken to hospital. Alfie was fine, shaken up, but not injured. But Mum had bitten straight through her bottom lip and she was being stitched up. I felt awful when I heard this. I also felt jealous of Alfie. He had been in the horrible, frightening car crash, yes, but he had been with Mum and he was with her in hospital now. They'd been through an ordeal together and it would be something they'd share, while I could only hear about it from the outside. I left Edgerly after 2 terms because I was unhappy. Somewhere else after Edgerly became a prep school called Dunhurst for a term, and then when I was 12 and September rolled around, it was Beedale's. Quite often, when I first became famous and one journalist or another wrote a takedown piece on me, one of their tropes was to accuse me of being a fake. Thought I was street, with my trainers and my London accent and my rough girl gobby opinions. Lily Allen, street. Lily Allen, who went to a posh boarding school like Beedale's. Who was I kidding? Overprivileged crybaby, Julie Birchall flung out in 2011. Public school tool, she went on. They obviously do things differently at Beedale's, she said, to explain something I'd said or did. I sometimes meet people who have been to Beedale's and they look at me with a certain kind of wary admiration because my rebelliousness there has gone down in legend. We heard you put acid in the milk machine, they say, but in fact I didn't do anything grand or dramatic like that at all. In many ways, I should have fitted right in there. Beedale's is known as an arty school, and for attaching as much importance to the extracurricular activities it offers, everything from photography to baking bread, as it does to the national curriculum it's obliged to teach. I continued singing there, and started learning to sing jazz, improvising and scatting with my voice while someone played the piano. There was also a teacher there who I immediately took to. He was called Alistair Langlands, and he taught English literature and classical studies. He wasn't a young or groovy teacher. He was in his 60s and he wore breeches and tweed jackets, but he approached teaching as a kind of storytelling, which I loved. For his classics lessons, he put whiteboards around the walls of the classroom and instead of wiping them down at the end of each class, he kept filling them up with the names of characters that we were learning about from Greek mythology and how they all connected together. That suited my memory, which works visually. Similarly, for our English lessons, when he taught us The Day of the Triffids, written by John Wyndham, who had lived close to the school, Mr. Langlands took us outside and into the landscape to read passages from the book, so we listened to the words while sitting in the very vegetation that had inspired Wyndham. That helped teach me that storytelling could be painterly and visual, and it's a lesson I use in my songwriting still. I don't want to write about a particular single feeling or settle on one refrain in songs. Oh, my heart is broken, gee, how I love you, etc. Instead, I try and build up layers of details. It's Tesco carrier bags that little old lady in LDN is struggling to carry. It's his parents' basement where my URL bad man sits at his computer in the song of the same name to deliver a whole picture and tell a contained story. Still, despite all this, I didn't manage to stay at Beedale's for even a complete academic year, and while I was there, I didn't do much work or make any friends with my own year group. This was because the summer before I went to school there, I'd been on holiday in Mallorca with Mum and her friend Siobhan, and there'd been a whole gang of kids and teenagers there that I'd hung out with. One of the boys was going into his last year at Beedale's. We'd made friends, and so once we'd got to school, his friends became my friends. That didn't go down well with the other girls. Boarding schools are run on hierarchies, rituals, and privileges are crucial. You move slowly up the ranks to earn little freedoms like a toaster for your common room or later lights out and access to more television time. And it isn't done if you're a new girl at the bottom of the school to leapfrog straight into hanging out with the alpha boys in the upper sixth. I didn't care. Our gaggle of friends would hang out and smoke fags, and once a week, on a Wednesday afternoon, we'd go into town and buy a box of white wine with a John Lewis store card that one of the boys had nicked from his mum's wallet. Then we'd sit in the forest near the school, get drunk, and let the boys finger us. All this was fine, but two problems reared up as the school year went on. One, it dawned on me that my cool older friends, all in their last year, would soon be leaving and that I'd be left behind with the rest of the school who resented me. That made me feel extremely anxious. And two, as June approached, the school said that they wouldn't let me go to Glastonbury. I went anyway. I think that's when Beedale's were like, no, we can't have this person at our school anymore. By July, I'd been kicked out. I wasn't going to miss Glastonbury. By this point, too, I knew that I could leave one school and start another. Drifting between places was almost becoming a habit. I'd translate my feeling of utter disenchantment, which was, I think, about being a child full stop, into dislike of the particular institution that I was at. This isn't right, Mum, I'd say about whatever school I went to. And because she was busy in America and not very engaged with what was really going on, she'd just tried to solve the immediate problem I was presenting her with. Of course, darling, she'd say. You can leave and let's get you in somewhere else. I'm not saying I didn't deserve a pasting from Birchall. I probably did. And I did go to Beedale's for 2.5 terms. But to define me by one of the many schools I went to and never felt a part of was neither fair nor wholly accurate. And so I resented reading Julie Birchall's piece and how she diminished and belittled my work by saying that I was handed it all on a plate. Keith Allen, posh. Britpop may have been about popular culture, apparently unifying class differences, but that's exactly it. Class differences. I was not born into the elite. Sure, I had media connections through my parents and an entree into the Groucho fucking club, but I managed to get a career in spite of that and my education, not because of them. The latter certainly didn't provide me with any useful training or qualifications. I don't have any A-levels or a single GCSE. I didn't ever do any homework. I never learnt how. No one sat down with me to do it, and so it just went undone. Even though it became this ball of worry inside me, the homework I never, ever did. That was part of the pattern of my childhood, the feeling of always being unprepared. For example, when I went to boarding school for the first time, all the girls had things like Tampax and deodorant. No one gave me that stuff, or gave me the talk about how to look after yourself, even in the most basic of ways. I think that's another reason why I, as an adult, so quickly latched onto men and was like, you're going to look after me now. As a child, I longed for adulthood. But as I got older, part of me wanted to remain a child so that I could fill up on what I felt I had been missing from my life, and that was being looked after. After I was expelled from Beedale's, my mum tried to get me to carry on with my schooling. I went to a couple of London crammers, which are schools that teach the curriculum on an hourly basis without any pastoral care or the structure of a school day. They mainly serve as kids who have failed their GCSEs or A-levels and need to cram one or two subjects before their retakes. Most of the kids at the crammer I went to were street-smart Londoners. I was fresh out of boarding school, and though I'd felt too London for a country school, now that I was back in London, I felt like a country bumpkin. There was a bully at the crammer who picked on me from day one, and because I didn't know how to handle her, I told my sister and her best friend Emily about her. They both went to a London day school and had street smarts to a fault. What? They said, all outraged. Some girl is giving you shit! The next day, they came into the college with me. Show us the girl, they said, and I did. Are you bullying our sister, they said into her face. No, no, she said, suddenly intimidated. Say no again, Emily said, clearly enjoying herself. Say it in my face. She grabbed the bully's glasses and flung them on the ground, then ground them into pieces. They beat her up. Not badly, but enough to frighten her. The next day, the headmistress of the crammer, a woman called Julia, called me into her office. Were you involved in the incident yesterday, she asked. No, I lied. I had nothing to do with it. I'm going to ask you that question again, she said. and this time I want the honest answer. No, I repeated, I didn't touch her. She switched on the TV in her office then and played me CCTV footage of Emily and Sarah beating up the bully while I stood by watching and laughing. That was my last day at the crammer. What are you going to do now? Julia asked me as she gave me my marching orders. I want to be a singer, I told her. It was the first time I'd said such a thing out loud, and I didn't mean it in a serious way. I wouldn't have dreamt back then of claiming singing as something I was good enough at to pursue seriously. To me, that would have been a kind of outlandish arrogance requiring the sort of confidence I didn't have. Singing? I hadn't even been to a stage school. To be a singer, like a well-known singer, that was fairy tale stuff as far as I was concerned. That was Whitney Houston being spotted in the gospel choir at church and then being introduced to someone famous and powerful like Clive Davis, who would wave his magic wand and make her famous. If that was ever going to happen in my world, it wouldn't be me who was spotted anyway. It would be the prettier girl, the blonder, taller girl, Olivia from Eggley, say, but not me. I didn't even harbour secret thoughts about it being my calling, not then. I knew I could sing. I knew even that I was talented at it, but I wasn't prepared to put myself on the line for it, to work my arse off to improve at it. I'd never said to Mum, look, it's actually the Anna Scher Theatre School or the Brit School for the Performing Arts that I want to go to, instead of another posh boarding school. Because whenever I thought about those places, I thought that I'd never get into those schools, and the last thing that I wanted was to risk any kind of rejection. So why did I say it? I said it because I had to say something, and it seemed logical to give Julia my best shot, to lobby her with the only thing that I knew I had excelled at, singing. I knew she wouldn't take me seriously, and I was right. Plus, I knew I'd never see her again, so I wouldn't be held to my word anyway. Just as I thought, Julia looked delighted at my response. It was so easy to dismiss. If it hasn't happened by now, sweetheart, she said acidly, it's not going to. Julia, I shouldn't have let my sister beat up someone and I shouldn't have laughed or lied, but whatever I didn't have, a sense of self, moral integrity, any kind of useful education, a single skill set, the one thing I had in front of me was time. I was 15 years old. In theory, the only thing I had was plenty of time to become or not become a singer. Note, if you read my list of thank yous on my first album, you'll see Julia's name on there. I thanked her for spurring me on. Her disbelief in me made me work harder. After that, it was no more school. My mum wouldn't let me sit around on my arse all day watching daytime TV, which I was prone to do, so I got a job as a runner at my godmother Henrietta Conrad's television production company, Princess Productions. I didn't have any burning ambition to work in TV, but I didn't have any burning ambitions. Instead, I flitted from one thing to another over the next couple of years. I was a runner. I waitressed, I got a job bussing tables and clearing plates at a restaurant called Latimer Place, and then at 192, the restaurant in Ladbroke Grove where everyone groovy in the media world would meet each other to exchange gossip and network over lunch and drinks and dinner. I'm not sure I was even paid to work at 192, but I knew an older girl, a waitress called Willow, who was the sweetheart of the restaurant and who I had a crush on and wanted to attach myself to. I remember seeing Paula Yates there, who was eating what would turn out to be one of her last meals. Certainly her last one in public, before she overdosed on heroin. You could tell she was in trouble when you looked at her. I had to talk to the police about seeing her as part of their investigation into her death. She was joined at lunch by this guy that we all knew was a heroin dealer. They'd left together. It was the saddest sight. But, despite my temporary occupations, what I said to Julia was not a random fuck you remark. It couldn't have been. I may not yet have taken myself seriously, but saying something out loud is important. It meant that the thought of singing must have been beginning to lodge itself in my head just a tiny little bit. Mostly, though, when I thought about myself and my future, what I thought was this. I'm 17 years old, and I've got no idea who I am or what I'm going to do with my life. But 17 was an important age for me. It was that same year that I met two life-changing people. One was a man called George Lamb, we'll get to him. The other was Lester. A lesson. I met Lester through my best friend Jess. She was friends with his cousin Becca, and they were part of a tight group of friends, siblings and cousins who hung out together in West London. They all descended, it seemed, from the same bohemian aristocratic families that ruled groovy London life in the 1960s, and they all seemed to share the unmistakable combination of jaded entitlement and debilitating lack of purpose that marks out trust fund kids. Lester's grandfather was David Ormsby Gore, who went by the title of Lord Harlech. He was a legendary figure. Glamorous, urbane and clever, he'd been the British ambassador in Washington when JFK was president, and after Kennedy had been assassinated, he'd been one of the men Jackie Kennedy had sought comfort in. They'd had an affair. His children, the Ormsby Gores, were famous in the newspapers for being beautiful, racy and troubled, one of them dying young of a drug overdose.